once again with the man who kickstarted this operation, David Mitchell, who is most recently the author of The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet, and I understand the original title is Zoot Suit Riot. Why didn't that stick?
Oh, it took ages to get the title.
Yeah.
Bat. I can call you Bat, can't I?
You can call me Bat, you can call me Ed, you can call me Shirley, whatever you want.
I'll stick with Bat.
Okay.
Yeah, Bat. Well, great to be back in your Bat cave. And yes, I had lots of titles. I couldn't think of it until the very, very, very last moment when literally my agent was in the back of the taxi from Frankfurt Airport to Frankfurt Book Fair, where he was going to, where his foreign rights people were going to try to sell the book to my European publishers. Friday before, we'd had a conversation. I still didn't have a title. Went out walking that weekend near where I live. I'd gone through 10, 15 other alternative titles. People in publishers are great at telling you why a title's no good. They aren't any good at
like
coming
what?
Up with a really great one.
Yeah.
I'm going to keep the misfires forever veiled, I'm afraid. Yeah. But Noel Redding, the bassist from the Jimi Hendrix Experience, came to live in the early 70s, well, after Jimi Hendrix died, to a house just over the hill from where I live. He was a quite a public figure for, or quite a colourful local figure. You can imagine someone like that arriving in mid-70s Ireland.
Yeah.
And he died about 10 years ago in that house. And I'm not superstitious and I don't believe in an afterlife, but nonetheless I was desperate and I prayed to Noel Redding. And within about 100 metres, I had this Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet pop into my head. I wanted it to be Dutch, English and Japanese. Jacob de Zoet, obviously this unpronounceable Dutch guy. Not pronounceable once it's been pointed out, but weird to the Anglo eyeball anyway. Obviously Dutch. Thousand Autumns is like the Land of the Rising Sun. It's one of the ways that Japan is termed in classical Japanese poetry. And Thousand Autumns, Jacob de Zoet, is obviously in English. Yeah. So that's how I could get English, Japanese and Dutch.
Along with the and of, which you have callously disregarded.
Along with
the and of.
Oh, the English words.
Yeah.
So that's why Noel Redding, even though he passed away some years ago, is in the acknowledgements, because whimsically, I like to think that the ghost of Noel Redding gave me the title.
That's interesting. You saw him through your own periscope, I suppose.
I like to think he went on the same daily walk as I go on, and from time to time I can meet him at dusk walking in the other direction, humming an old Hendrix bass line.
I wanted to get into the book. On the ship, you have Van Cleef insisting that he's not for sale to any monarch, yet he's all too quick to sign that bill of lading. Similarly, Dr. Marinus, for all of his professed cultivation and civilization, for his railing against racism and barbarity, you have him basically shouting out to the seminarians to observe the medical possibilities within the execution, as well as the listening moment as well. I wanted to ask you if the investigation of these moral hypocrisies came largely through the structure of your narrative, or whether these characters were fixed, or whether the narrative essentially pushed them into these gray areas of moral existence. How did that work for you?
Mimesis. I want to write like the world is, and we live in moral gray areas. Marinus, I would like to defend him for a moment. He is on the side of the angels, even if they're somewhat ambiguous, scuzzy angels who could do with a good shower. He's disgusted by what's happening, but at least it's happening anyway, so he's going to try and derive some grain of good from it, which is allowing his students to save lives in the future. But everyone else, it's a nest of vipers, that place. Human vipers don't like to think of themselves as vipers. It's a common trait. They prefer to think of themselves as good, pragmatic businessmen. They may well not be good, but we aren't comfortable. But even human wolves have consciences, and they're regularly ignored. But some kind of balm is to nudge the language and think of yourself in more complimentary terms, even if the rest of the world might not agree. it is one of the themes of the book. I don't start off with themes. Themes sort of slowly kind of come up to the surface, like carp in a murky pond. And as I was writing it more and more, I realised that the book's just about these little compromises. No one is an act of evil. No one compromise, no one step, no one, well, yeah, I know this rule's good, but just today I'm going to wave a little bit. It's all fine, step by step, but when they're compounded, that's how we cross a borderline into immorality or amorality.
But surely when you laid down a particular plot point or a particular moment that basically causes the character to be hypocritical. I mean, my question really is one of whether these characters were going to be doing this anyway, or whether you, I suppose, tilted your characters in the right direction by putting them up against walls and conflict along those lines. I mean, how these gray areas came about, it just seemed to me that when they ran into the wall, it was very clear that their gray areas were beholden to the reader there. So I have to ask, just, you know, from a...
Sure. I'd kind of like to say both. In the first case, plot is dependent upon change, and changes of mind, changes of stance, the gap between what a character says and then what the character does. That's time-honoured means of propulsion through a novel, through a narrative, through any kind of a story. People aren't what they seem. People are worse than they seem. That's one direction you can take it. Other direction, people can be better than they seem. That also works well. So that happens anyway in fiction. Specifically here, Dejima's a kind of stasis tank. It was designed to keep change out of the country and let the money in and let the trade out, but to keep change out. The Tokugawa shogunate liked their country just the way it was, thank you very much, with them ruling the roost and them on top. So although I was fascinated by Dejima, this trading post in Nagasaki Harbour that the Dutch maintained for 240 years, once I started writing about it, I kind of realised, what have I stepped into here? It's an anti-plot engine. It's a force field to keep out the agents of change. So I was in a hard place. My way out was to kind of keep it within... to keep everything confined within the walls, as the Dutch were, but within those walls, I brought in as much change as I could in the form of moral drift, personality drift, people having sort of, if you like, scoundrels having streaks of virtue, and apparently virtuous men actually being quite willing to sell their consciences to the highest bidder.
Yeah.
Which, alas, is a universal theme, but it's one that's still with us.
But there's more violence in this book than any of your other books. You've got executions, you've got chickens' heads being ruthlessly cut off at a game, and not only that, just to kind of try to compress a lot of points in a small amount of time, but you also have a lot of parallels going on between the first part and the second part. Slavery, for example. It's no different no matter where you stand in a class structure. So to sort of tie the big bundle of morality that you were juggling here that caused the characters to often collide against the wall and to cause their true nature to be shown, I'm wondering, from an intense standpoint of this violence, whether you really felt it was more of a pressure cooker situation just in terms of creating the narrative engine this time around, whether it was delving back into history, and also to bring in the parallels as well between what's going on within Nagasaki and beyond, as well as Dejima.
I know. No, sure. As you were talking, I was sort of thinking it's history.
Yeah.
We are calling it violent, and it seems very, very violent, visceral book, because we are lily-livered 21st century, fortunately born democratic citizens of states that, on the whole,
management, there's no recorded in the law.
Understood, okay, thank you.
I've been beat up, I've been kicked around, I've been thrown out of every damn bar in this old town. In this old town, I guess I don't like the way we like to have. having fun, cause I'm always out there and I'm all
okay.
The
conversation continues. David and I have been kicked out of the hotel, and we are now sitting outside of the hotel. As he was about to explain moral hypocrisy in the lily-livered 21st century, we didn't stand up to them, did we? There you go.
A conversation was not going to happen there. Those are much, much more violent times than these, and if you and I were ever transported back in a time machine, we would last 48 hours before collapsing in a screaming nervous breakdown and being thrown into bedlam for our pains. Mimesis. I just want to write how I feel the world was, and it was a violent, bloody, visceral place where one birth in 10 ended in death for the infant, one in 15 for the mother. Those figures are rather off the top of my heads, but off the top of my head, heads, head. I bet they're not far out.
Yeah.
Life was shorter. It was more brutal. People had less recourse to the law. In Japan, there was no recourse to the law. You belonged to a social group, and there were conventions and precedents governing behaviour there. But if you were a peasant and you displeased a samurai, we could lop your head off.
Yeah.
And no one batted an eyelid. Bat.
Yeah. I wanted to also ask, I mean, touching upon that, you have a lot of 20th and 21st century references within this book, I noticed. Otene's medicine cabinet is one. You have, of course, Otene says, when it is hot, she adds the egg. And I thought that made me think of Ernest Dichter's cake mix situation. Not sure if that was intentional, and that's a bit of a stretch for me. But scissors, paper, stone, which I learned emerged from Japan in the late 19th century. And yet, there it is there with Marinus and Sugita. I'm wondering if, and also you did in fact say snap, crackle, and pop at one point, which made me think of Rice Krispies. I wonder if these were little subtle ways of nudging the reader out of their lily-livered 21st century complacency into this historical epoch.
Nope. At the proofreading stage, every sort of question mark is, I think of in terms of legal trial. A legal trial in which something is, in which the guilt has to be proved, the guilt of being wrong, the guilt of inexactitude, the guilt of historical historical impossibility. These things have to be proved rather than the innocence. So prove to me that nowhere in Japan was the game of scissors, paper, stone being used at the end of the 18th century. If you can't, then it's in the clear, it's innocent, and it can stay
it's
in the text.
It's fair game, yeah.
Snap, crackle, pop. That came from somewhere. Yeah. It came from somewhere. Proved to me that the combo of words, which, yeah, is well known for a cereal advert, kind of couldn't have also been used 200 years ago. If you can't prove it, then I'm going to keep it in the book, unless there were other overriding reasons for keeping it out, you know?
Yeah. I also wanted to ask you about the games that are throughout this book. You've got Go, of course, but Grotz card games, the billiards situation. I am curious if why games proved very good for you in terms of having a social setting, having those Elroy one-line cross-cutting descriptions proved exceptionally good for gaming, or whether this was a reflection in some capacity of what goes on in the Mitchell household, if you're a board game guy or something, I don't know.
Well, we didn't have a TV in the house, so actually my daughter and I spend hours devising, making our own snakes and ladders boards with all sorts of weird and wonderful hyperlinks. And so, yeah, we do think of games a lot, actually. They're a bit of a gift to a novelist because it gives your character something to do apart from talk.
Yeah.
And you can sort of leaven the loaf of dialogue with non-dialogue lines about people playing the knave of spades and things. Drama and dialogue, indeed, usually involves confrontation. Two people wanting two different things, which, of course, a game is a microcosm, a reflection, an echo, a model. So they're good for that reason, too. Lastly, our old friend, historical mimesis. Even now, in 2010, we have a hard time remembering the pre-internet world, what we did with our time. But amplify that by 20. It's a world with no TV, no radio, low literacy.
Loads of animals, too.
Lots of animals.
Yeah.
More rats, no pest control. apart from a cat or a dog, etc., etc. We did games more in the past. We did, because there was nothing else to do. And on Dejima, there's nothing else to do. You can't get off. Can't go anywhere. Can't leave until the ship comes.
Yeah.
So I think it's really plausible that they would have spent their days playing games and drinking, and when they had the money, whoring.
Yeah. Well, I mean, speaking of giving the 21st century reader an angle in, as well as this cross-cutting one-line description, this book is, to my mind, far more cinematic in its description than your other books. Lots of shafts of light coming in, lots of, you know, the light hitting Sergeant Nash on the ship. And I am curious also, the situation with William Pitt, where he has the foot. I mean, I was thinking, boy, that's David Lynch's Wild at Heart. The situation, I mean, of course, and then Van Cleef, Lee Van Cleef. So, and Uzumon, near the end of the second part, imagines a sequence of pictures, and there are pictures within the book. So, I'm wondering if movies or visual imagery, how much of this was a part of trying to get in the contemporary reader into a rather mammoth historical epic setting.
Yeah, good one. Never been asked that before. And it's interesting your attention is drawn to characters like Sergeant Nash and William Pitt, who no one's really ever asked me about. Maybe it's not that I wanted to use cinematic techniques to make a historical and potentially difficult novel more accessible and less difficult for a contemporary reader, as much as it's simply what helps make the book work.
Yeah.
It's not that, I mean, I've never met a reader at a bookshop that I felt any need to dumb down for.
Yeah.
Especially here in the States, you've got there's smart, literate people, more so than me, at my events. So, in a way, I'm on the same side as the reader. It's, what can I do to make this book work for me? How can I do this? How can I sort of frame it all? I've got a theory, and it's improvable, but I think film has altered what the imagination is somewhat, and how it works somewhat. And I think when I see scenes, when I'm writing, well, I think that's it. I see them first in a big, large rectangle. First I see them, then I work out what it must smell like, what other things they can hear, what little insects might be coming through, what, etc., etc., etc. But first, I see it. Utterly improvable. Unprovable? Improvable? I cannot think. Unprovable, I suppose. Non-provable? I'm stuck. Never mind.
You can say whatever you want.
But I don't think 19th century writers would have worked like that. I'm quite sure how they would have done it. I think more word-based. I think. And I think perhaps the other senses had a sort of stronger initial stake in at the moment when the scene is imagined,
yeah,
than the visual sense. I think cinema has possibly nudged the visual sense forward at the expense of the auditory and the olfactory and the whatever the Latin word for touching is, etc. Yeah. See what I mean?
No, I think what you're describing here is that words are almost a middleman or a tension holder between the question that is proffered by one character, what does it feel like to kill a man, that sense of emotion, versus this sense of imagery. Yeah. I mean, you know, the thing about the light that's interesting in this book is that you can see it, but you can't feel it in the way that you can feel a lot of the other emotions that are going on in terms of characters. And I found that to be quite interesting because in the real world, I mean, here we are, and it's a very hot day. We're sitting on the outside of a lobby
because we've been phoned
trying to carry out a conversation.
Oh, and I'm enjoying it.
You can feel the heat. Maybe you can remark upon why there's almost this dichotomy, or why words split the difference like that.
I think of words as vehicles that convey what I'm thinking into your that convey what is in my imagination into someone else's. And words are weird sort of inner dialogues because they don't just replicate what is in the imagination. They can alter it. You can mistype and you get a word that actually can be better than the one you meant. Words can sort of feed back and suggest to your imagination, well, wouldn't it be neater if you imagine this instead? So it's words, language itself is a kind of a writing partner, separate to the writer who is deploying the language, I think. I think this is true. Does that answer your question?
It sort of does. But maybe actually there's one thing I wanted to ask you, and that is with Orito. You investigate the flashback of her sexual assault, yet in the shrine, we don't really see the true horror of what's going on. I mean, granted, it's from Orito's perspective, but I'm wondering why you didn't really go into what was happening. I mean, she could have observed the engifting, which, I mean, it sounds horrific in terms of from a what-is-not-seen standpoint, to use a cinematic idea. But I'm wondering why you didn't go full-born, or if there was even a draft where you did, in fact, go into that dark territory and proved it's too disturbing? I don't know.
I didn't know how to do a sex scene in inverted commas that involved engiftment and for it to not stink of misogyny. And as a male writer, that's sort of even worse. Is, you know, I mean, in blunt terms, if you can ever hear a writer jerking off as he's writing, then that's it. Then the book's dead.
Yeah.
It's if you just that's a crude thing to have said, but
you can say whatever crude things you like.
It's what I meant, and you kind of know what I mean.
Yeah, I do. But on the other hand, you are dealing with an age from centuries ago when it was, in fact, a very misogynistic atmosphere.
Most certainly, you get
a lot of that in the book. Yeah. But I'm just curious why. I mean, don't we have to really look at these really terrible and dark feelings squarely in the face in order to really get at the truth? Or
if it's happening now, about a place a quarter of a mile from the Helmsley Hotel that we've just been kicked out of in downtown New York, and it's a social wrong, and women have been trafficked from godforsaken parts of the world and are being exploited like this, dead right.
Yeah.
Shine cold, hard truth, truthful light onto it, please. It's got to be stopped. This is fiction from 200 years ago, and it hasn't got that same social imperative. That wrong in this day and age does not exist to be righted. It is an echo of Dejima, which is also a place that no longer exists. It's a novelist's requisite. That's what the shrine on Mount Shiranui is. And for me to sort of be offering scenes sort of on camera as opposed to off stage, where such physical exploitation is taking place, I think would have gone over a kind of writerly ethical mark in the sand, which I chose not to go over.
What would that ethical mark in the sand be for you? I mean, it seems to me like maybe for you, other people, like, you know, Brian Evanson comes to mind, will go across that mark and by doing so, really risk the idea of being impugned as a misogynist, even though there is no misogyny in their particular intent. I mean, I'm wondering if it's an overstated concern, perhaps, of your part, or whether this is just one of those lines in the sand you will possibly cross in the future in some capacity, staring some really terrible truth in the face like that. I mean, you do, don't get me wrong, but I'm just, this is an interesting question here.
If it's a real terrible truth, it has to be stared in the face.
Yeah.
If it's an unreal, made-up, quasi-historical, fictitious, terrible truth, then to be describing institutionalized rape on the page in hard porn vocabulary terms, I feel, sounds like me jerking off in front of my laptop. And all of a sudden, 98% of my readers have left the building, and I'd probably have gone with them. Had I been a reader of the book.
Would you call, say, something like Bret Easton Ellis' American Psycho jerking off?
Firstly, I can't say what I'll be writing in the future. I don't know. Secondly, just to go back to the question you've... two questions ago, and actually one question ago as well. I don't begin to sit in judgment on other writers who handle this, who make this call in a different way. And I've read that book, and it works very well. It's distressing and awful and upsetting, and it works very well.
Yeah.
And good luck to him, really. But here in my book, In a Thousand Autumns, Jacob Zoo, it felt wrong. And I've had a pretty blessed life, but I've also had enough hurt and pain to know it's real stuff.
Yeah.
And it's not to be toyed around with just because, hey, I'm going somewhere no one else has gone before. You have to treat your own female characters with respect as a male writer. I, whilst not being afraid to show the moral hypocrisies going on and the way that these things are justified quite plausibly, quite kindly, by the men who are conducting this kind of farm, that I'm not afraid of doing at all. Why would I be? But the language that they use, a term like ethnic cleansing, these sort of soft little euphemisms that we, when reality is too horrific to be true, what gives, what bends, is actually the language used to describe it. And these euphemisms, rendering, waterboarding, they sound quite pleasant. They sound quite Beach Boy-esque, don't they? But always watch out when you hear words like that, because it means the reality is too horrific for that spade to be called a spade. And watch out for euphemisms. They're sure signs. Now, this kind of thing, I'm really happy to explore in the book, and I do it, and that's great. But the thing itself that is being euphemised about, the this farming of newborn children for purposes that I'm not going to talk about because I don't want to spoil the book for anyone who hasn't read it. It's crucial that I don't sort of waddle my fingers in that gore in a sort of gratifying, self-regarding, look how brave I'm being kind of a way.
I bring that up because it does resemble the farm that's in the midsection of Cloud Atlas.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
And
yeah. Hadn't thought of that.
And the fact...
So it does.
You seem to be really concerned with the idea of slavery, particularly in the first two parts of the book. And this is why I'm convinced that what we're talking about here is an interesting fusion between these moral hypocrisies and, of course, the narrative steam engine. At the end, we've got the clearly influenced Patrick O'Brien.
Which is
great and all, but that's what I'm wondering is can you really pursue these dark and dangerous and really heavy topics that involves serious exploitation? I mean, I haven't even brought up the slave chapter that was from the perspective of Wed. The only time the book slips into the first person. This is also interesting to this question. Can you really explore dark terrain like this and stop short of the mark? That's the question. Is this something you're still figuring out?
It is, and it's an ongoing debate that I have with myself. If you feel the book works, then I can, and one can. If you feel the book doesn't work, then perhaps one of the reasons it doesn't work is because it can't be done. You do have to sort of slip into a, not sexual porn, but a kind of porn of a pornography of violence. Maybe you do. And I can't judge my own books. I have no idea if they work or not. I never do. It's not slavery so much as power. I'm interested in power and control and the imposition of one will over another. Slavery is merely an extreme form of that, but playground bullying is also a form of that. And there'll be new forms invented in the future, no doubt. The way human beings battle and compete and as if we're sort of hardwired at some deep level to dominate and to impose our wills over others. Reality TV, to a certain degree, can often feed into this, things like Big Brother. And you get walls and enclosed environments, so there's no way out. The institution of slavery is one such wall. Literally, you're walled in and chained up, and there's no way out. But there are more invisible forms of walls as well, and more invisible chains and shackles that kind of bind dominator and dominated, and the dynamic in that, and the rebellions, and the suppressions, etc. Yeah, I'm interested in this terrain, most certainly, and a lot of my books inhabit it.
Yeah. Well, I also wanted to, because we've got very little time, but I'll do my best here. I wanted to actually ask about the aphorism. You have common idioms that are in use today in the dialogue, versus individual aphorisms that are often in the italicized, what's going on inside the character's head, what a gesture expresses. Just to offer some examples, Snitker refers to revenge being a dish best served cold, even though, well, of course, it's going back to what I was saying earlier, its first appearance in European literature was actually in 1841. I just got so curious. Van Cleef noting that old habits...
Wasn't dish served cold from Macbeth?
You're right.
Hey.
Never mind. So
it's okay, Bats. Go on.
You bested me. So never mind. Van Cleef noting that old habits die hard. The cook saying all's well as ends well. Speaking of Shakespeare, a friend in need is a friend indeed. And then you have these individual aphorisms like Penn Haglian saying, "Power is a man's means of composing the future." And my favorite from Jacob was, "When shaving, a man rereads his truest memoir." I'm also tempted to read half a Hollander's minute as your answer to a New York minute, but I wanted to ask about the sort of common idioms with the individual aphorisms thing that you were doing. The fact that these aren't really voiced so much as they are thought, as they are interpreted, is really interesting. Was this a way to grab the reader into a sort of the lingua franca of this landscape, or how did this come about?
Bygonese is a language you need to devise when you're writing historical fiction. If you go for pure 100% authenticity, you end up with something that smacks of pastiche and Blackadder. It's funny. It's actually comic. There have been too many historical spoofs for you to write historical fiction in a genuine 18th century voice for it to not be funny to a 21st century eyeball. However, of course, to over-neologize the prose is also to pop the bubble of fiction. If Jacob says, "That's so not what I meant."
Yeah.
Of course, and that comes from Friends, it comes from American sitcoms in the 1990s, and has that "so" as an adjectival modifier, I think, has invented right here and exported successfully through Globish. So you have to sort of create this fictional dialect that never existed, and I call it bygonese.
How do idioms get into the bygonese?
If they're not there, you will sound like the onboard Enterprise computer.
Yeah.
You have to have them. Pepper them with authentic ones, which HBO series John Adams does very well. I've got a lot of things from there. Damn your bloods. We don't say that anymore. But it's great. And you know what it means? There's no comprehension problem there. Damn your bloods. And things of that ilk. Idioms, it's a lesser crime to have ones that perhaps really from the later 19th century than the first years of the 19th century. It's a lesser crime to have them than idiomless prose. It's weird. It's not how people speak. That's a more serious crime, to have people speaking, not how people speak. So, Webster's Online Etymological Dictionary, is it Webster's? There's a great one. And there are times, where historically I am wrong, and bygonese is wrong, and this sentence wasn't recorded, its first appearance doesn't happen until 30 years after my book. If people... Well,
did you create like a running list of what was in use at the time, from like in terms of idioms or cliches and that kind of thing?
My proofreader and editor did it retrospectively for me, as I didn't know about the website when I was writing it. And I changed a lot.
Yeah.
Borderline cases I kept in. on the grounds of, as I was talking before, the court of fictional plausible, the court of historical accuracy, it's still just about not guilty. Prove that no one ever said it 30 years before, and you can't. So I'm going to use it. Thank you very much. I hope for the average reader there's no problem with this. If a reader derives pleasure from catching me out and, this idiom didn't exist until 30 years later, then I'm very glad that he or she has enough time and a pleasant enough life to have nothing better to do. I need to make the book work, and to strip it of idiom just because it's 30 years too early would make the book not work. And my first loyalty is to the book,
yeah,
rather than to
history,
an etymologist,
yeah,
or a historical etymologist.
Well, history too, where you've taken, I mean, obviously there were different Dutch commissioners in Dejima, and of course there was an ambush in Nagasaki's harbor in 1808 from Captain Fleetwood Bellew, the HMS Phaeton, which you've changed to the Phobos.
Yeah.
And so what's interesting is I completely bought the book, and then I looked it up and I'm like, oh, it's totally wrong. The question is this meant to be more of a verisimilitudinous parallel universe, or does historic fiction have any real obligation to history? Do we overstate that obligation?
I rammed into that question probably about 18 months after starting the book, which sort of made me have to rewrite a lot of it. Big stuff you can't change, otherwise you're into the genre of alternative history, and that's not where I wish to work. Small stuff you should make up, otherwise you're not writing fiction, otherwise you're not writing history, you're writing, I'm sorry, otherwise you're not writing a novel, otherwise you're not writing fiction, you're writing history and biography. Medium-sized stuff, like the HMS Phaeton, change, tweak, but flag your tweak. So Phoebus is the son of Phaeton, or the father of Phaeton, I forget which. The son, I think.
Is this also how Cupido and Philander ended up, because there's this great emphasis on, you know, mythology like that? Or?
That's because the slave owners gave their slaves fancy names, the same reason that the car manufacturers or horse owners give their cars or horses fancy, mythological, cool, or perceived to be cool in that era, names.
One last question, because sure. I know you got a jam. I wanted to ask about Dr. Marinus. I know he's appearing in other books, but if he's appearing in the future, I must ask if this is kind of a nod to Neal Stephenson's Enoch Root. Have you read Neal Stephenson? Are you familiar with this?
Yeah. No, I haven't read him, but you're the 20th person to say how wonderful he is.
Really? You haven't read him?
I haven't.
He writes in history, and there's a character called Enoch Root who appears in multiple time periods. Shares some temperament with Marinus, which I found quite great. That's interesting.
I Wikipedia'd him. immediately was deeply envious of the name Enoch Root. That is the perfect name for a grouchy immortal. I then realized that it's probably best, in my best interest, to not read him, so that I don't have to work at making him different, and he can kind of be who he is. Yeah, he's a conditional immortal, which stems from a midlife awareness that when you're 20, you know you're going to die, and when you're 40, you know you're going to die, and you know there will one day come a Tuesday where no one can phone you or email you or text you, because you do not exist anymore.
Yeah.
And nothing can be done about that, but it's still kind of neat in fiction and in art to do something about it. Just because it is.
Well, the Moon Grey Cat from Black Swan.
You're
Green.
So observant.
I mean, bat,
you clever bat.
That's the obvious one. But I wanted to ask about whether this was intentional or not. Kobayashi, name of one of the interpreters, is also the name that Quasar takes in Ghost Written. Is that deliberate too, or?
That one isn't.
Oh, okay.
It's the name of a colleague at a university in Hiroshima where I worked, and for some reason that name always, it's an eyeball friendly name, it works. However, Eiji Miyake's ancestor, or Eiji Miyake, a character from Number 9 Dream, the protagonist from my second book, his ancestors knocking around in here, and you can find that name. There's about five links.
Yeah.
It's hard to get any more because it's chronologically, it predates anything else I've written, but there's about five I could get in.
Yeah.
Happy hunting, bat.
On that note, I know you got to go, but I just on the interconnectedness thing. I mean, why do you feel obliged to continue this interconnectedness? I mean, do you have a long-term baseball game here for things that are intended for like book number 8, book number 9, or is this really a way to, as you did when I found 4 of the 5, I think? Is this a way to get people rereading the earlier books? Is this your marketing technique?
No,
literary marvels here.
How awful would it be if I said, oh, it's a marketing technique? No. It pleases me. I've got a sort of flaky theory about transferable concreteness of reality. When if you believe someone's real in another book and they appear in another, if character A walks into book B, then all the plausibility and the credibility that the world of character A had in his or her first book, that's somehow sort of transferred and sloshed into book B, I think. Thirdly, a more recent reason, it's the biggest net I can make to try to capture the world.
Yeah.
And maybe it's a naively ambitious thing to wish to do, but it's there. I want to try and just net the world, and the biggest net I can make is a net made of not one big book but of all of my books. That's the biggest net a novelist can try to trawl reality with, and that's what I want to do.
Okay, well, with that in mind, David, thanks so much for enduring being kicked out of a hotel with me.
Hey.
And talking in under a grueling tour.
It's a grungy down on the street with a kid
really
kind of an interview.
But thanks so much, and I hope to talk again.
You're welcome.
Absolutely.
You're welcome, Pat. It's a real pleasure.
I'm writing this to you in reverse. Someone better call a hearse. See it all from here, from just a few glimpses. Now that light bulb's gone off and it's pulling my wings in.